From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. More than 2,500 inmates in America's prison system are serving life terms for crimes they committed as juveniles. We'll explore whether society is served by sentencing youth to life in prison through the story of one Tampa-area man. He faced four back-to-back life sentences for his role in a string of robberies committed when he was 14 and 15 years old. His story is the subject of the POV documentary 15 to Life, Kenneth's Story, premiering in August on PBS. Plus, it's been just over 4 years since the well was capped in the Deepwater Horizon spill, which discharged an estimated 4.9 million barrels of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. We'll hear from researchers fresh from an expedition documenting the ongoing impacts to marine wildlife and the Gulf ecosystem. We'll also explore environmental restoration efforts from a legal and policy perspective. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. It's been 4 years since the Deepwater Horizon rig explosion. An oil spill took the lives of 11 people and discharged 210 million gallons of oil into the Gulf of Mexico. The well was capped on July 15, 2010, and was finally declared sealed on September 19th of that year. Although cleanup efforts have largely removed the visible signs of oil from the surface, researchers have continued to document the Gulf's recovery and ongoing impacts of the spill on the Gulf ecosystem and on marine life. For the rest of the hour, we'll be taking a closer look at some of these ongoing efforts. Joining me now is CEO of the nonprofit Ocean and Whale Research and Advocacy Organization, Ocean Alliance, Dr. Ian Kerr. The Ocean Alliance has teamed up with Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, perhaps best known for the Animal Planet television program Whale Wars, for Operation Toxic Gulf. Ian Kerr recently returned from a marine expedition in the Gulf with the Ocean Alliance Sea Shepherd team. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Yeah, hi, John. Thank you very much. Really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners today.
Also joining us by phone is Sarah Gonzalez-Rothy-Cronenthal. She's a senior policy analyst for the Gulf and Coastal Restoration for the National Wildlife Federation. Her work is primarily focused on Gulf of Mexico restoration in the wake of the Deepwater Horizon oil disaster. As a Florida native, Cronenthal previously worked as legislative counsel for Senator Bill Nelson, where she served as a key staffer, in the draft negotiation and final passage of the Restore Act, which designates 80% of civil and administrative penalties paid in the BP oil spill to go toward environmental restoration and protection efforts for the regions impacted by the spill. Sarah Cronenthal, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's my pleasure.
I invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. Connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments and questions on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or join our live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Ian Kerr, let's start with you. Why did the Ocean Alliance team up with the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society? And how many marine expeditions regarding the Gulf, regarding Operation Toxic Gulf, have you guys been doing together now?
Yeah, thank you, John. Well, this actually will be our fifth summer in the Gulf of Mexico. We came down immediately after the spill, and we've been using marine mammals, particularly sperm whales, almost as a sort of bio-indicator for the region. And what's interesting for Ocean Alliance is that we've actually been around the world, visited 21 countries with our research vessel Odyssey, and we've collected toxicological data on sperm whales all around the world. So this really gives us an opportunity to put what we find in the Gulf into a global context. And as I'm sure you're aware, if you can't put something into context, you're somewhat lost. So we felt there's a unique opportunity here. And again, obviously this is a terrible disaster where 11 people lost their lives. We're certainly not here to sort of beat anyone up per se, but alas, this is an opportunity for us to learn, what does it mean to the animals that live in the deep waters, way offshore where the spill happened. So we are looking at chronic effects. That's, the effects over time, which is why it's great that we've managed to return every year for the last 5 years.
And there are a wide variety of research efforts looking into the ongoing impacts of the oil spill. Some are looking specifically at dolphin mortality. Others target impacts on sea turtles, specific species of fish, or other marine life. And you're looking at sperm whales. Tell us why sperm whales in particular serve as a good indicator species.
Well, they are actually the largest toothed animal that has ever lived on this planet, you know, and as a toothed animal, they're at the top of the food chain. And, of course, what happens currently, it's sort of a shame, but the oceans are downhill from everything. So everything sort of washes down into the oceans, and you get three things that really concern us. One is the bioconcentration, which is a lot of these fat-soluble compounds, whether they be man-made or natural, dissolve in the fat of plants and small animals, and then as each animal in the food chain above feeds on the food chain below, you get an amplification of 10 times per trophic level. And there's about 7 trophic levels in the ocean's food chain, and sperm whales and humans are really at the top of that trophic level. So they really are, as I say, great bioindicators. They're mammals like humans, so really, If we really want to understand what's going on with the complex sort of ecosystem offshore and potential long-term effects to humanity, I think the sperm whale is really the right species to work with.
And tell us about the nature of the data you're either able to gather from the sperm whales. I mean, are you taking biopsies from dead sperm whales that you find, observing their behavior in the wild?
Yeah, well, actually, we're taking biopsies from live sperm whales. So,
how on earth do you do that? I'm sorry.
We do it very carefully. No, there's sort of an industry standard worldwide that has been used for over 20 years now. And we have a small crossbow that fires a dart that takes a plug of skin about the size of a pencil eraser, okay? Mm-hmm. With that plug of, actually, skin and blubber. So with that sample, you've got the skin, which can give us the genetics, you know, the DNA. Is it Ian? Is it Sarah? Do you know what I mean? Is it male? Is it female? At the skin blubber layer, we have the active cells, and we actually put these cells into culture. And we're working with the WISE Laboratory for Environmental Toxicology at the University of Southern Maine. And Dr. WISE and his team grow these cell lines. So technically, on the boat, we have cell lines growing in little dishes on the boat, and then we expose those living cells to different concentrations, different doses of, if you like, of environmental toxicants. And basically, a quick sort of premier on toxicology here, everything is toxic. Toxicology is all about the dose. Too much oxygen is toxic. Too much water is toxic. So we want to know what dose has what effect on cells grown in culture. You know, when they look at the effects of toxic compounds ashore, they often do what they call LD50 testing, where you take 30 animals and you keep feeding them environmental toxicants until you've only got 15 or half of the group left. Well, you can't do that with endangered species. So we are very interested in not just what's out there, you know what I mean, what are we finding in the animals, but what does it mean to these animals? And obviously, we collect whatever other data we can. You know, whale feces is important because we can see actually, you know, what the animal's been eating, and we're finding squid beaks, and we find certain levels of hormones. So we're really, it may be a bad analogy, but I feel like we're sort of running through a burning library and grabbing everything we can while we can, so that we can then look at chronic effects over time. And what's interesting, when you do the cell culture work, we can do low-dose exposure to the cells and actually look at the concentrations that give us DNA damage. And DNA damage speaks to chronic effects, you know, which could affect the reproductive fitness of the animal and even the life of the calf, et cetera, et cetera. So we are fairly soup to nuts in what's out there at the top of the food chain and what does it mean. And you did ask briefly about Sea Shepherd. You know, we're a scientific group. You know, we've been sort of doing some of this work, sometimes incredibly boring, for the last 43 years. We have a southern right whale program that's in its 43rd year now. But we're not so good at getting the story out, and Sea Shepherd is very good at getting the story out. And as I've mentioned, I think to you when we first spoke, I'm deeply concerned that there are over 21 species of whales in the Gulf that we know very little about. And most people don't even know there are 21 species. And then there's a species of whales called a Brutus whale, of which we think there's only 15 to 25 animals left. So, alas, when you look at all the different threats that are on these animals, from entanglement to acoustic to toxicology, you know, an event like this spill really could be the nail in the coffin for a population of whales like the Brutus whale.
Wow, so we could, you know, potentially see a species brought to extinction.
Right, and in today's date, I mean, in today's society, you know, how do you get the idea of extinction across to people? You know what I mean? Extinction, that's it. It's gone. Right. You know, if you think that everything that humanity has done and everything we know about the planet, you know, it's all gone. You lose a species, it's gone. And that should not be happening on our watch.
And if I understand correctly, as far as, you know, what you're measuring in these sperm whales from the biopsies, you're seeing elevated levels of metals like chromium and nickel. What does that indicate?
Well, correct. I mean, we actually were lucky enough to get a sample from the riser head of the oil, so we could look at in the crude oil, so we could actually see the levels of metals that were actually in the crude oil. And this is what the refineries do. You know, they take out all of the things that you don't want to be burning, you know, in your engine or whatever. So a lot of people have been quite focused, as we are, on the use of the dispersants and what do the dispersants mean. But we've got to remember there's also a lot of other stuff that was released into the Gulf, and clearly high levels of nickel and chromium. And a lot of people are aware of the effects of chromium due to the movie Aaron Brockovich. So it's nice when you can talk to a metal, at least, that people understand the effects of. And it's certainly what we call cytotoxic to sperm whales grown in culture. I'm just looking at a graph here that Dr. Wise did, and we found that in culture, 50% of the cells died at a dose that was 30 times lower than what we found in tar balls. So this is chromium levels. So we looked at the levels of chromium we found in the tar balls, and 37 times lower than that was enough to kill 50% of cells that are growing in culture.
Wow. You know, and again, these are, you know, this is a known agent to alter DNA, a carcinogen.
Exactly.
And going back to the issue, and this is something that appears, as I understand it, in the oil itself. But looking at the issue of the chemical dispersants, things like core exit, in the immediate aftermath of the crisis 4 years ago, the response was largely focused on getting rid of the oil as quickly as possible, which resulted in the application of more than 1.8 million gallons of chemical dispersants that were applied on the ocean surface, injected into the wellhead. While these efforts certainly worked to remove the appearance of oil as quickly as possible, do you think that effort may have been short-sighted?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I'm sorry to say, I'm convinced that the cure here was worse than the disease. I mean, basically, we, you know, I understand why they use the dispersants. They're worried about it washing up on the shoreline. I don't know. I'm not into politics. I don't know if there's a political issue of sort of out of sight, out of mind. But the reality is, you took sort of a finite slick and then dispersed it, you know, throughout the food chain. And you know, if I came to your house with a bag of sort of smelly flour, would you rather I put it on your dining room table, or would you rather I dispersed it throughout every room of your house?
Right.
And the reality is here, too. People don't realize that the two productive parts of the ocean are the top 50 feet and the bottom 50 feet, okay? And the animals at the top are really relying on photosynthesis and sunlight, and then a lot of these animals die, and they fall down to the bottom, and then at the bottom are the crabs and the mollusks and other species that rely on the sort of the fertile period, the fertile area at the bottom of the ocean. So dispersing these toxicants through the whole water column and then actually potentially laying a lot of them, you know, on the ocean floor, I think it's increased its toxicological potential over time as against decreased it.
And we have a question coming in from Barbara on Twitter. Do they do any research on bottlenose dolphins? My understanding is, I know there is ongoing research involving a researcher with Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota within our broadcast range, but was that not really within the spectrum of the research you were doing?
Well, it hasn't been. And in actual fact, NOAA has been doing this work, but I think NOAA has got a challenge here because I think they're using a lot of the data they're collecting in their sort of ongoing court cases with BP. But what we do know, as you've probably heard, is over 1,100 dolphins have washed up on the shoreline of Florida and the Gulf Coast since the spill. And, you know, just to get something clear here, when they talk about an animal like bird deaths, they say if you find one bird, it's likely that 10 other birds died. Personally, and this is just my opinion, I think when you talk about marine mammals, you're probably talking 50 to 1, because most marine mammals, when they die, they just sink, okay? So, you know, for every one to wash up, there's a potential there that 50 just died at sea. And you know, it's interesting, and this is, if you don't mind, anecdotal data. I don't think the data is complete yet. But a lot of people are saying they're expecting a virus that has killed the dolphins. And this is a virus that they've been exposed to for many years. And you say, well, why suddenly are we getting an exponentially higher die-off of these animals from this virus than we had before? And it speaks directly to the sort of immunosuppression effects of some of these environmental toxicants.
And I wanted to read another comment that's come to us from Karen through Twitter. She writes, the effects of the Deepwater Horizon spill, and then in parentheses, I use the word loosely, as it was definitely not just a spill, will be felt for generations to come. Just because it is capped does not mean that it all is okay. People tend to lose interest once the media stops dramatizing. This was an enormous event to the entire Gulf and eventually to any area that the Gulf Stream touches. Do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I say good on you, Karen. I mean, the reality is, you know, when we look at the Exxon Valdez spill, 25 years later, they're still looking at effects to a herring population. There's actually a group of orcas there that lived in Prince William Sound that have not had a calf since that spill, 25 years later. So I think that that particular population of animals is functionally extinct. But I have to say at the same time, I really am a positive person. You know, I believe humanity has enormous potential. I'm disappointed that I feel the offshore waters and the marine mammals have been somewhat ignored in this whole issue because they are also out of sight, out of mind. But I do believe that if groups like Ocean Alliance and many other groups out there that really care are collecting the data, you know, present the data in a credible manner, that's how we bring about change. And, you know, again, I remember when I first bought seventh generation cleaning products, you couldn't find them. They were hidden at the bottom of the shelf, and now they're sort of front and center. So I think if people make wise choices about what they eat and what they put in their bodies and what cleaners they use and how they live their lives, you know, we can change the world.
And Sarah Cronenthal, I know you've been waiting patiently here. Your work with the National Wildlife Federation and previously with Senator Bill Nelson's office has been aimed at the policy and legal side of environmental restoration in the aftermath of the spill. Tell us a bit about your efforts.
Yeah, that's correct, but I could listen to Ian all day. I'm certain could too. In terms of the legal and policy side of this, you mentioned at the beginning of the segment here that this is the largest man-made environmental disaster in U.S. history. And as a result, it's got a very large legal piece to it. And so you start with the actual liability for damages to the natural resources. And there's a process called the Natural Resource Damage Assessment that was created in the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, just after the Exxon Valdez oil disaster. And that's what Ian was mentioning about the ongoing work by NOAA to collect data specifically on bottlenose dolphins, but also on other living creatures and natural resources in the Gulf of Mexico, is that they are building their case to prove the damage to natural resources so that the responsible parties can be held liable for those damages. That case is ongoing. In addition, it's been sort of merged with the civil penalties that will be leveled against BP for violations of the Federal Clean Water Act. And so just the same that if you were speeding, you would get a civil penalty assessed to you, the same is true when you violate the Federal Clean Water Act. So civil penalties can range per barrel spilled from $1,100 to $4,300. And the question for the court is, was the actor grossly negligent, or was this an instance of simple negligence? And in this case, it's clear that BP continuously put profits over safety in one of the most productive ecosystems in the world. And as a result, we had an oil rig gushing for 87 days in the middle of the spawning season of many of these natural resources. And so that dollar amount is likely to be anywhere up to $17.6 billion. So we won't know until the trial comes to a conclusion what the total amount for the natural resource damage and the civil penalties will be, but there are already some sources of funding that are coming through that can be used for restoration and the kinds of things that Ian was speaking of in terms of addressing the injuries to marine mammals. And so BP settled with the United States Department of Justice and the Natural Resource Trustees to the tune of $1 billion of what they call early restoration dollars. And as we've gone along the process over the last 4 years, you've heard announcements along the way of early restoration funding in each of the Gulf states. In addition, BP settled for criminal violations of the Clean Water Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and other federal statutes to the tune of $4.5 billion. And some of that funding is being spent to address natural resource harms by the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. So that work is also ongoing. And the last piece I want to talk about is the Restore Act, which is going to take a portion of the Civil Clean Water Act fines and direct them back to the Gulf of Mexico for restoration. And so our organization has been working in all the Gulf states and also at the federal level to figure out what those opportunities for restoration are and how to best make them a reality.
All right. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for explaining things to us from the policy side here and, securing that funding so that this type of research can continue. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today's show, but thank you so much to Ian and Sarah.
Thank you. And thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Excellent work.
Dr. Ian Kerr is the Chief Executive Officer of the nonprofit research marine research and advocacy organization Ocean Alliance. Sarah Cronenthal is a Gulf and Coastal Restoration Senior Policy Analyst for the National Wildlife Federation. There's more information at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live, and conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and Luke Martin. This is WGCU Fort Myers 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.